From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. In honor of St. Patrick's Day, we bring you the story of a forgotten Irish-American songwriting team, Harrigan and Bram. They wrote songs about New York for the stage in the late 1800s, before Tin Pan Alley. We'll talk with Mick Maloney and hear music from his CD of their songs. Also, Lloyd Schwartz remembers Betty Hutton. The singer and actress died this week at age 86. Film critic David Edelstein reviews The Host, a South Korean monster movie. And we'll hear from country music singer Charlie Louvin. He's got a new CD, his first studio work in a decade. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Tomorrow is St. Patrick's Day, so we're starting today's show by visiting with Mick Maloney. He's the singer, guitarist, and Irish folklorist who released a CD last year covering the songs of lyricist Ed Harrigan and his writing partner, composer David Bram. You may not be that familiar with the music, but you may know Harrigan. From a tribute song sung by James Cagney as vaudevillian George M. Cohan in the movie Yankee Doodle Dandy.
H-A-W-R-I-G-A-N
spells Harrigan.
Proud of all the Irish blood that's in me, and divil a man can say a word agin me.
H-A-W-R-I-G-A-N-U-C
is a name that a shame never has been connected with Harrigan. That's me. H-A-W-R-I.
Harrigan and Bram plied their trade and wrote their Irish-American songs in New York City in the 1870s and 80s, predating Tin Pan Alley. Maloney was born in Limerick and has lived in the U.S. since 1973. He has recorded and produced more than 40 albums of traditional music. His latest CD, the one Terry spoke to him about last year, is called McNally's Row of Flats, Irish-American Songs of Old New York by Harrigan and Bram.
Mick Maloney, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like you to introduce the first track on the new CD, which is called McNally's Row of Flats. Would you describe this as one of the really early songs about city life in America?
It is indeed one of the early songs about city life in America, and it comes out of the context of Lower East Side Manhattan, where Ed Harrigan lived along with David Bram. And this was a time in the early 1880s when this song was written, when Irish immigrants were living beside Italian immigrants, and they were also living beside African Americans and Chinese immigrants. Eastern European immigrants were arriving, mostly Jewish, from Russia and Ukraine. And the whole thing was a real multicultural mosaic. And the song gives a very good flavor of that.
Okay, a song about multiculturalism long before anybody invented the word. Here it is, McNally's Row of Flats.
Down in Bottle Alley lived Timothy McNally, a decent politician and a gentleman at that. Beloved by all the ladies, the gossoons and the babies that occupy the building called McNally's Row of Flats. And it's Ireland and Italy, Jerusalem and Germany, Chinese and Africans, and a paradise for rats. All jumbled up together in the snow and rainy weather, they constitute the tenants in McNally's Row of Flats. That great conglomeration of men from every nation, the Tower of Babylonium, it couldn't equal that. A peculiar institution where the brogues without dilution, they rattled on together in McNally's Row of Flats. And it's Ireland and Italy, Jerusalem and Germany, Chinese and Africans, and a paradise for rats, all jumbled up together in the snow and rainy weather. They constitute the tenants in McNally's Row of Flats.
That's Mick Maloney from his new CD, McNally's Row of Flats, Irish-American Songs of Old New York by Harrigan and Bram. Would you just place us musically here? I mean, this is an era, we're talking like 1870s to 1890s.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of precedes Tin Pan Alley.
It does, yes.
So what are the entertainments of the time?
Well, you would think of Gilbert and Sullivan around that era. That's the late 1870s. Actually, Harrigan and Bram started writing songs about 6 or 7 years before Gilbert and Sullivan. Some of the songs have somewhat of the same feel to them. Of course, Gilbert and Sullivan go into opera and operetta, and Harrigan and Bram and Hart, they stick with musical comedy, musical theatre. But say a song like, say, The Mulligan and Guard, which was their first big hit. If you look at it, the sheet music, it will go something like this. We crave your condescension, we'll tell you what we know, from marching in the Mulligan Guard and the Sligo Ward below. Our captain's name was Hussey, a Tipperary man. He shouldered like a Russian duke whenever he took command. We shouldered guns and marched away. From Baxter Street, we marched to Avenue A. Our fifes and
drums so sweetly they did play as we marched, marched, marched in the Mulligan Guard.
Now, when I went and listened to that in sheet music, it didn't sound like that much of a big deal. And I knew that it needed something as a window into the past to make it more evocative of the original feel of the music in its context. This was the era of marching bands, of course. So I went to Vince Giordano, who has a band, the Nighthawks, and they played for 15 years up in 48th and Broadway at Charlie O's. Big fan of their music.
They do swing tunes and early jazz.
Yeah, early jazz. And Vince is a great knowledge of early American music, especially 20th century music. This was a little bit before his time. But with him and his arranger, John Gill, who also plays in the band, we sort of stepped back another few decades at what might this have sounded like in a pit orchestra in the Harrigan and Hart and Braham era. You're talking about the 1870s. And we did what we felt would be a fairly decent reconstruction of what it would have sounded like then, with the feel, however, of today as well. Because the intent was never, when I started making this CD, the intent was never to reconstruct anything, but to more or less get the flavour of what it was like and then do it as if it would have been done today by Harrigan.
Well, why don't we hear how it sounds on your CD with Vince Giordano's band behind you? So this is the Mulligan Guards.
Your condescension, we'll tell you what we know of marching in the Mulligan Guard from the Sligo ward below. Our captain's name was Hussey, a Tipperary man. He carried his sword like a Rooshan duke whenever he took command.
Forward! March!
We shouldered guns and marched away. From Baxter Street, we marched to Avenue A. Our fifes and drums, so sweetly they did play, as we marched, marched, marched in the Mulligan Guard.
That's Mick Maloney from his new CD, McNally's Row of Flats, Irish-American Songs of Old New York by Harrigan and Braham. And that was Vince Giordano's band backing him up. Now, this song is about, what, a neighborhood militia?
A neighborhood militia, because after the Civil War, there were a lot of people dressed up and nowhere to go. And the whole idea of having militias that will go and do target shooting really proliferated in New York. Dickens wrote a lot about it. He was appalled by the number of people who clogged up the arterial routes of Manhattan any given Sunday. Basically an excuse to have a big picnic and drink a lot. And a lot of these target companies, as they were called, were ethnically and fraternally based and often based in particular neighbourhoods. So they were very competitive. So the whole idea was really to go and do some target shooting. But that somehow got overwhelmed by the idea of having a big party, lots of drunkenness. And it was a very New York, a very urban New York. So this was satire from the very start. And the strange thing about it was that the song became the most popular song ever for Ed Harrigan and David Braham. And it was taken up by almost all the military bands. John Philip Sousa's band played it, Gilmore's band played it. It was even played in all the British regimental bands. And Kipling, in his novel Kim, even mentions a regimental British band in India playing the Mulligan Guard. He even quotes the first chorus. I doubt if that old imperialist would have known it was written by an Irish-American as a send-up of the military.
Now, the lyricist for the songs that you do on your new CD, mm-hmm. Ed Harrigan, was part of a duo with Tony Hart. They had an act that they did in minstrel shows.
They did. They both started out as minstrels. And if you were an entertainer in urban America in the 1860s or really any time before that, after 1840, you really didn't have a whole lot of options. You had to black up if you wanted to be a professional musician. And Harrigan did that. Also, Tony Hart, whose original name was Anthony Cannon, he was an immigrant from County Mayo. Ed Harrigan was born in Manhattan in 1844, and Anthony Cannon, who became Tony Hart, was born in 1855 up near Massachusetts, near Boston. And they met up in Chicago and they teamed up and they became known as the team of Harrigan and Hart. So they moved from minstrels to variety theatre, from there to musical, to inventing musical theatre.
What do you mean when you say that they invented musical theatre?
Before that time, variety theatre had presented music and song and dance along with sketches as part of one long evening of sequential acts and entertainment. What they did, beginning with the expansion of the Mulligan Guard idea, was to create one full-length exposition, a play if you want, with music and dance and song woven into the play and adding characters all the time. So the Mulligan Guard starts off as three people. By the time it's gone through its six different incarnations, there's a cast of over 25 different people. And they represent ethnic New York. There's Walshingham McSweeney, who owns the saloon. There's Gustavus Luckmuller, the German butcher. There's At Wong, the Chinese laundryman, who also has an opium den, and there's a cast of Irish characters, and it expands, representing in a sense, I suppose, the first realism in theatre in New York, in that New York was being given itself back on stage for the first time in a comprehensive way. And Harrigan went and bought clothes in secondhand stores. He went even to the immigrant ships coming in, and he bought the clothes off the backs of the immigrants, so you could arrive in America on a Monday and see your shirt up on stage on a Saturday night. It was that realistic, and he very deliberately sought to represent New York, but in a very good-humoured way.
We're describing Harrigan's music as preceding Tin Pan Alley. Mm-hmm. You know, in Tin Pan Alley in its early years was really dominated by a lot of Jewish songwriters like the Gershwins and Irving Berlin. Is it fair to say that before there were so many popular Jewish songwriters, there were a lot of popular Irish songwriters?
There were a lot of popular Irish songwriters and also a lot of very popular Jewish and Irish teams of songwriters. When you hear of songs, for instance, like the one that was a big hit in Ireland some years back, My Irish Mollio, that was written by Jerome and Schwartz.
Really?
Who also wrote If It Weren't for the Irish and the Jews. And you would think, well, Jerome and Schwartz, they're surely two Jewish songwriters. Well, they weren't. Bill Jerome was actually William Flannery from County Mayo. And nobody knew exactly how the entertainment industry was going to go in the 1890s. And people were hedging their bets. And some people like William Flannery said, well, it's definitely going Jewish. I'm Bill Jerome. Where Nora Goldberg arrives from Milwaukee. And she says, I don't know which way this is going. I'm changing my name to Nora Bays. And I'm going to sing, has anybody here seen Kelly? K-E-double-L-Y. So it went in both directions. And then after 1900, there was a lot of the Jewish Irish songwriting team in the early years of Tin Pan Alley, more or less supplanted later on by Jewish songwriters. But there was that whole two decades where there was kind of an ambiguity.
It sounds like one of the reasons why Harrigan lost his audience is that the audience changed, like the ethnic makeup of the audience.
They
changed.
Did, and Harrigan lost touch with his biggest asset was his powers as a wordsmith, and his sense of humor, which was tied to that. And he became middle class himself, but the old neighborhoods stopped being Irish and African American and German, and particularly immigrants came in from Eastern Europe who were Jewish. And Harrigan complained in his writing that these people, he said, had no sense of humour. And of course, he was completely wrong. He knew nothing about Yiddish theatre. He just wasn't, the humour wasn't available to him because of linguistic reasons and cultural reasons. So he lost touch with the old neighbourhoods, and New York changed and humour changed. And also the recording industry was in now in the late 1890s, and tastes were changing, as they always do in America. And in popular culture, you have a few options. You can reinvent yourself, which he wasn't able to do, he was just too old. You can wait until your time comes around again. And he was too old for that. Or you can just fade away, which is exactly what he did.
Mick Maloney speaking with Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2006 interview with Mick Maloney. They're talking about McNally's Row of Flats, his CD collecting the period songs of Ed Harrigan and David Bram.
In rediscovering the songs of Harrigan and Bram, did you find yourself rethinking a lot of songs from early American pop history? And I'm wondering if there are any songs that you maybe used to dismiss as kind of commercial or schmaltzy or, you know, silly, that once discovering more about their history, decided are actually pretty interesting.
Well, yes, and I think the more you learn about the social context of the songs, and the more you learn about why people bought into an idealized notion of a homeland, because, I mean, the horrors of the real story were too much to deal with in day-to-day life. You can't just relive trauma all your life. Life would literally be hell. It wouldn't be worth living. So Tin Pan Alley specialized in creating these sanitized images of homelands for so many immigrant populations in America. I think once I started to realize that, and once I started to talk to people who love the songs and realized that their grandparents had at least something positive to say, even if it was an invented reality, I started to feel very sympathetic towards the songs, some that I might have dismissed completely. This is one in case, and in fact, this was the classic Jewish-Irish Tin Pan Alley songwriting team of Dubin and O'Brien. I'll see if I can remember this now. Oh, you should have seen the sights I saw, 'twas just the other night. Oh, you never saw the likes of it, 'twas such a pleasing sight. I was happy for a moment, but now I'm feeling blue. For what I saw I'll see no more, 'twas too good to be true. Oh, the shamrocks are bloomin' on Broadway. Every girl is an Irish Colleen. And the streets of New York are the county of Cork. All the buildings are painted green. Sure, the Hudson is just like the Shannon. Oh, how good and how real it did seem. I could hear mother singing, the sweet Shandon bells are ringing. 'Twas only an Irishman's dream. And I see a beauty in that now that I would not have been able to see some years back.
When did you rediscover the song?
I always knew it, but I started to feel differently about it when I started to delve into the story of Immigrant Song and Tin Pan Alley. And when I started to ask myself the question, why did this resonate with so many Americans for so long? And I realized this was a time of extraordinary social transition from an old country to a new country, an old way of life to a new way of life, from the countryside to the city. And this was a time when America was urbanizing at a tremendous rate. It wasn't just America, foreign-born people who identified with these songs, anybody from the countryside. Songs about that which is that left behind, which was idealized.
Harrigan starts off as a minstrel performer. He performed in blackface, as you mentioned. Is he still performing in blackface when he's writing his own shows and performing them in New York? And if so, like, what's the context of the blackface?
Well, he is. And all the way through his career, he continues to perform in blackface. In fact, the Mulligan Guard was his most famous set of characters. And right parallel to the Mulligan Guard and all the Mulligan Guard series was the Skidmore Guard, which was an African-American target company. And they would come in contact often with a lot of what they call knockabouts, brawling on the stage. Of course, it was the same cast in blackface, and that never stopped. One of the reasons Harrigan said in his own comments later was that he admired African-American music and he admired the capacity for singing and dancing. But of course, it was still a minstrel representation. There were no African-Americans at all on the stage.
Do you know any of the songs that he wrote for any of the blackface songs?
I know a lot. I know of them. And in fact, there's a wonderful book with 200 Harrigan songs that are now edited by Joss Finson. And I wouldn't touch most of those songs. They're very racist by the standards of today. Would be considered quite the norm at that time in the minstrel tradition.
Now, does that bother you? Does that get in your way of enjoying Harrigan's songs?
It does to some degree. When you look at the whole body of work, there's such a strong minstrel component in it. And of course, that's bothersome because it's racist. There's no two ways about it. It was of its time. And I think minstrelsy is a very complex chapter in American musical and in social history. And I certainly would find it very, very difficult to sing any of those songs.
I want to close with another song from your CD, and this is really a lovely waltz called Danny by My Side. Would you tell us about the song?
Yes, it was written just a few years after the Brooklyn Bridge was built by the Roeblings, designed one of the great structures in late 19th century America, in a sense of almost a symbol of what American ingenuity could create. And it was, as well as being a highly utilitarian structure, you know, increased the traffic flow between Brooklyn and Manhattan exponentially. It was just a beautiful sight, and people came from all over America to look at it, and indeed from all over the world to walk across the Brooklyn Bridge, and it was the talk of the day. And Harrigan, of course, grew up just a few hundred yards from there. He didn't miss the opportunity to write, I think, one of his most beautiful songs, Danny by My Side. And Bill McComiskey came up from Baltimore. Dana Lynn, who's originally from Los Angeles, played the fiddle, and Brendan Dolan played the piano, and we had a great time.
Mick, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much. It was an honor.
Mick Maloney speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. His CD collection is called McNally's Row of Flats, Irish-American Songs of Old New York by Harrigan and Bram. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
The Brooklyn Bridge on Sunday is known as Lover's Lane. I stroll there with my sweetheart, oh, time and time again. It's then I love to ramble, oh, yes, it is my pride. Dressed in my best each day of rest, with Danny by my side. Then, oh, my, do try taking the bridge on a Sunday. Laughing, chaffing, happy the lovers go by. Moonlight, starlight, watching the silvery tide. Dressed in my best, each day of rest, with Danny by my side.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Virginia Woolf's early novel, Night and Day, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts at pewtrusts.org, funding the international traveling exhibition, Benjamin Franklin, In Search of a Better World, now in Denver. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting health insurance coverage for all America's children, on the web at covertheuninsured.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You've already put big old tears in my eyes. Must you throw dirt in my face?
Coming up, Country Music Hall of Famer Charlie Louvin joins us. He's got a new self-titled CD. Also, David Edelstein reviews the South Korean monster movie The Host. And we remember Betty Hutton. The stage and screen star of the 1940s and 50s died this week at age 86.
All you gave me was the gate. I've got a feeling you've come back to just rub it in and to really put me in my place. You've already put big old tears in my eyes, lest you throw dirt in my face. Must you keep telling me got a new love? I don't need you to remind me. Must you keep telling me I look so lonesome and my better days are behind me? Must you keep showing me pictures of him and boasting of his warm embrace? You've already put big old tears in my eyes. Must you throw dirt in my face?
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley. Betty Hutton was one of Hollywood's most popular musical comedy stars of the 1940s and 50s. But she wasn't happy in Hollywood. And at the height of her success, essentially, she stopped making films. She died this week, having just turned 86. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz remembers her fondly.
Okay, fellas, hit it.
There's a doctor. doctor living in your town. There's a lawyer and an Indian too. Neither doctor, lawyer, nor Indian chief could love you any more than I do. There's a barrel of fish in the ocean. There's a lot of little birds in the blue. And neither fish nor fowl, says the wise old owl, could love you any more than I do. No, 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 it couldn't be true that anyone else could love you like I do. I'm gonna warn all the dead I did.
I loved Betty Hutton when I was a kid. Her uninhibited, overflowing exuberance probably made up for my own shyness. I thought she was wonderful as the silent movie serial star Pearl White in The Perils of Pauline, and as the aerialist hopelessly in love with Charlton Heston in Cecil B. DeMille's The Greatest Show on Earth. I was sure it was her performance that got the film its Best Picture Oscar. She blew me away as sharpshooter Annie Oakley in the movie version of Irving Berlin's Annie Get Your Gun, though seeing it again recently, she seems badly directed. She was called the blonde bombshell because she virtually exploded every time she appeared on screen. She was a good singer, too, and had a number of hit songs, mostly specialty numbers written for her, like He Said Murder, He Said, and I'm a Square in the Social Circle, and Hoagie Carmichael's Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief. But she could also really deliver a slow ballad like Frank Lesser's Too Little Known, I Wish I Didn't Love You So, and Berlin's They Say It's Wonderful.
They say that falling in love is wonderful. It's wonderful. So they say. And with the moon up above, it's wonderful, it's wonderful, so they tell me. I can't recall who said it, I know I never read it, I only know. The thing that's known as romance is wonderful, wonderful in every way. So they say.
She was right in considering her best movie, Preston Sturges's brilliant, rule-breaking wartime comedy, The Miracle of Morgan's Creek. She plays Trudy Cockenlocker, a small-town girl who wants to do something for the boys in uniform. She goes out on a date with a soldier, gets married that night, and when she learns she's pregnant, can't remember who it was she married. After Hutton left Hollywood, her career sputtered out, as did her four marriages. She became addicted to painkillers. Years later, she was discovered working as a cook and housekeeper in a Rhode Island rectory and credits the priest there with saving her life. She actually went back to school, got her degree, and even did some college teaching. She got her start as a band singer and on Broadway and occasionally returned to live theater. It must have been in the mid-1970s that I saw her in Cole Porter's Anything Goes at a dinner theater called the Chateau de Ville in a distant suburb of Boston. A couple of friends and I got tickets for the opening night. It wasn't much of a production, and it was especially disappointing that she wasn't in very good voice. She actually stopped the show twice, literally. Once when she inserted a medley of her greatest hits, which was fun, but the second time was more painful. She was trying to do a Fred Astaire bit in which she tapped a cane against the stage and caught it as it bounced up. But she missed it, so she tried it again. I'm going to do this until I get it right, she announced, and repeated the shtick 7 or 8 more times until she finally caught the cane. The evening was beginning to seem like a disaster, until at one point she sat down at the edge of the stage and, completely out of the context of the show, said she was dedicating the next song to her ex-husband. At a very slow tempo, she almost whispered the most moving version I've ever heard of I Get a Kick Out of You. She ended in real tears, and as they say, there wasn't a dry eye in the house either. After the show, my friends and I decided to go backstage. She was very welcoming and was eager to talk about her career and the ex-husband who mismanaged it and undermined her confidence. The next day, the run of Anything Goes was canceled. It was a sad end. But that irrepressible personality is still there for us in her best numbers and in her marvelous comic performance in Miracle of Morgan's Creek, her one movie masterpiece.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches English at the University of Massachusetts, Boston.
Anything you can do, I can do better. I can do anything better than you.
Oh, you can.
Yes, I can.
Oh, you can.
Yes, I can.
Oh, you can.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Anything you can be.
Earlier this week, we played a recording of Anything You Can Do from Irving Berlin's Annie Get Your Gun, which we believe was performed by Betty Hutton and Howard Keel, thanks to an erroneously attributed track on the compilation we used. However, we heard from a few attentive listeners who were sure that was not Betty Hutton singing, and they were correct. One of our listeners helped solve the mystery. What we played was a Judy Garland performance. This recording, the one we're listening to now, is with Betty Hutton and Howard Keel, thanks to our attentive listeners.
Anything you can wear, I can wear better. In what you wear, I look better than you.
In my coat.
In your vest.
In my shoes.
In your hat.
Oh, you can.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Anything you can say, I can say faster.
I can say anything faster than you.
Oh, you can.
Yes, can.
I can.
Yes, can.
I can.
Yes, can. Yes, can. Yes, can. Yes, can. Yes, can. Yes, can. Yes, can.
I can jump a hurdle.
I can wear a girdle.
I can knit a sweater.
I can fill it better.
I can do most anything.
Can you make a pie?
No.
Neither can I.
Any note you can sing sweeter.
I can sing anything sweeter than you.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
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 No.
Coming up, country singer Charlie Louvin. This is Fresh Air. The Louvin brothers are considered one of the great vocal harmony duos of country music. Their songwriting and tight harmonies inspired countless country acts, as well as musicians that straddled the country rock line. They were popular at the Grand Ole Opry and well represented on the country music charts from the late 50s until the mid-60s, when the act broke up. Brother Ira was killed in a car accident soon after, but Charlie Louvin has continued to record. The Louvin brothers were inducted into the Country Hall of Fame in 2001. Charlie Louvin, who turns 80 this year, has a new CD out, simply called Charlie Louvin, his first in a decade. It finds him in duet with the likes of George Jones, Elvis Costello, Will Oldham, and Jeff Tweedy. Terry spoke to Louvin back in 1996 when he released his CD, The Longest Train. She asked him if he missed singing harmony with his brother.
I'd always believed that any song's worth singing is worth putting harmony on. And, of course, I had grown used to that for the 23 years that my brother and I had worked together. And even today, 34 years after he's gone, when it comes time for the harmonies to come in, I will move to my left because my brother and I always just used one microphone. And so you had to share the mic. And I will move over to the left to give the harmony room, knowing in my mind that there's no harmony standing on my right. But it's just old habits are hard to break.
Your early recordings were gospel tunes. Many of them were originals. In fact, why don't we hear one of those originals that you co-wrote with your brother Ira? This was made in 1952, and the song is called "The Family Who Prays."
The family who prayed will never be parted. Their circle in heaven unbroken shall stand. God will say, my good faithful servant. Has parted fathers and mothers, filling their hearts with his envy and hate, heading their pathway down to destruction, leaving their children like orphans to stray. The family who prays.
The Leuven Brothers from 1952. Chet Atkins featured on electric guitar?
Yes, Chet recorded our first Capitol record with us, and Chet is a big part of the Leuven Brothers sound from The Family Who Prays right on through to the end of the Leuven Brothers career.
You were singing a lot of gospel songs early in your career, but I know your brother Ira had the reputation of being a heavy drinker and of having quite a temper. Did you share the same religious convictions? Did you live with the same kind of values, or was there a big difference there?
No, a lot of us know better, but we don't do better. He knew better. He is extremely well-versed on the good book. As far as knowing what was right or wrong, he just wasn't able to conquer the devil, I guess. But we didn't have any major problems with the drinking until, I'd say, not end of 1958. The Leuven Brother records, the sales slowed down as all other country artists did in 1958 because the music was changing. And so our producer told my brother, I believe that it's the mandolin that's keeping the Leuven Brother Records from selling, which had always been a featured part. My brother worked hard to become proficient on the mandolin. And when this producer, namely Ken Nelson, said this to my brother, and my brother feeling that Mr. Nelson was a close friend and a trusted friend, he believed him. And so he would never play his mandolin again on a recording. After that statement, if it would come up, somebody would say, oh, I think this would sound good with the mandolin. My brother would say, no, I'll let the piano do it or let the guitar do it. Anybody, but I'm not doing it. And it caused him to drink extremely heavy, and he went to between then and the time he passed away, went through three wives and just lots and lots of problems that he never could whip.
I want to play another original gospel song that you recorded called I Like the Christian Life. This is really a beautiful song. Graham Parsons loved this song and used it on the Byrds album Sweetheart of the Rodeo. Do you remember writing this?
No, I don't. Things went and come in the Leuven Brother career, sometimes my brother would be a totally good man. He could have been a preacher if he wanted to. He was that knowledgeable of the good book, and he had the gift. But my brother was the gifted songwriter. I came up with the ideas. If I could give him a title and a few words of the story, he could write it in 5 minutes. So this is the way we worked. I don't specifically remember the day that that song was wrote, but I remember that my brother was attempting with all of his might to live a Christian life. So at that time, and the statement was made, I like the Christian life. He thought that might make a song, so what you're about to play is what he got just from that title.
Let's hear it, and this is from Charlie Leuven's new album called The Longest Train.
My buddies tell me that I should have waited. They say I'm missing a whole world of fun. But I am happy, and I sing with pride. I won't lose a friend by heeding God's call. What is a friend who'd want you to fall? Others find pleasure in things I despise. I like
Charlie Leuven from his new album, The Longest Train. Did friends ever mock you for trying to live the Christian life?
No, but I wouldn't say they mocked. When you're not living the Christian life, you have one set of friends. And if you're going to profess to live a Christian life, it's obvious that you're going to have to change friends. You're going to have to change a lot of habits, old habits being hard to break. Sometimes it can't be done. So if you prefer to hang around with your old friends, there's a good chance that you'll drift right back into doing exactly what you are trying to get out of doing.
You and your brother broke up the Leuven Brothers and went your separate ways in 1963. And it was, I think, just about a year later that your brother and his wife were killed in a head-on road collision, and I think it was the driver in the other car that was drinking and that was responsible for the crash. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. It happened in Missouri, halfway mark between Kansas City and St. Louis. My brother was coming home from an engagement that they had been on in Kansas City, and the other two people was going from St. Louis to Kansas City to celebrate Father's Day. They just started celebrating it too early, that's all. They didn't wait till they got out of that car.
How did it change your life when your brother was killed?
Well, I had already become a solo artist, so to speak, Terry, and I had released, or Capitol Record people had released, I Don't Love You Anymore, which went to the number one spot. And I believe the second song was Think I'll Go Somewhere to Cry Myself to Sleep. It was doing good at the time. And my brother kind of felt that somebody had done him wrong, but I hadn't. Music is the only thing I knew. And so naturally, I would try to stay in the business, and because he had sworn to me that he was getting out of the business. However, he was making attempts to get back in the business. Had a couple of records released for Capitol Records. Neither one of them had done anything, but I'm sure that if he would have been given time, he'd have figured out what the public wanted, and that's what he would have gave them.
Charlie Louvin, speaking to Terry Gross in 1996. Here he is on the new CD called Charlie Louvin, singing the bluegrass classic, My Long Journey Home.
Lost all my money but a $2 bill, a $2 bill, boy, a $2 bill. Lost all my money but a $2 bill, and I'm on my long journey home. Cloudy in the west and it looks like rain, looks like rain, boys, looks like rain. Cloudy in the west and it looks like rain. I'm on my long journey home.
Coming up, The Host. Not me, the movie. This is Fresh Air. In the year 2000, a U.S. military civilian employee in Seoul, South Korea, ordered a Korean subordinate to dump a large amount of formaldehyde into a sewer pipe leading to the Han River. The incident aroused violent anti-American sentiment in Korea and led to the birth of a monster movie called The Host. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The Korean hit The Host is built like your standard-issue Grade B giant monster attacks a city picture, but its tone is all over the map. Now it's a horror movie, now a dark political satire, now a dysfunctional family psychodrama that's like a grisly reworking of Little Miss Sunshine. I have friends who were bugged by its mad shifts in tone, but that's what I enjoyed, the switchback ride from pathos to farce to gut-bucket exploitation. It turns out that the marauding giant monster genre is fabulously elastic. You can learn a lot about a society by how it copes with a marauding giant monster. Describing this particular monster is a challenge. It's kind of a slithery, bounding, mandibled, squid-like reptile with nasty fangs. It seems to relish gobbling people down. It also seems to relish regurgitating their bones in front of horrified onlookers. One more thing. It's American, insofar as it was born of formaldehyde dumped into the Han River on the orders of a military officer played by Scott Wilson. The director and co-writer, Bong Joon-ho, does not depict the U.S. military presence on the Korean peninsula with affection. Not only does the American-spawned creature wreak havoc on Korean leisure activities, the virus it apparently hosts triggers a secondary chamber of horrors. People who've been exposed are rounded up and quarantined, with American army doctors leading the charge. But the heart of The Host is a family saga. The monster carries off an adolescent girl named Hun So, and please forgive my Korean pronunciation. The creature is pissed off at the girl's father, Gang Do, a pudgy ne'er-do-well with dyed blonde hair and narcolepsy, who nonetheless clobbered it with a heavy pole while it was chomping some sunbathers. The beast keeps the girl alive amid the corpses, future meals, in its sewer lair, but she gets hold of a cell phone and calls her dad, who's unfortunately in medical quarantine. In the unstable society of The Host, family is the only thing you can rely on. The problem is that Hun So's family is nuts. Much of The Host revolves around the father's effort to escape his American captors and rescue his daughter, but he and his brother and sister are borderline inept. The brother is a perpetual student who's never gotten over the ineffectual pro-democracy riots of his youth. The sister is a near-champion archer, brilliant until it's time to let the last arrow fly when she's paralyzed. This family, along with the elderly father, and their Looney Tunes passions, which are staged to look both genuine and ridiculous, nudges the movie out of the B-monster class and into weirder territory. As scary as the monster is a demented American surgeon played by Paul Lazar, who for political cover-up reasons wants to give Gangdu some kind of lobotomy. I've made The Host sound like a romp, but it's actually pretty grim. People we care about don't survive, and it's hard to shake off the first sight of the creature in the far distance, hanging from the side of a bridge like a pupa, then sliding into the water and gliding toward the shore of the riverfront park, to the oohs and ahs of the people on their picnic blankets who rush over and throw food to it, not realizing they're about to become its food. But the reason The Host transcends the genre is that it's a funhouse mirror reflection of its country's deepest anxieties, a cauldron in which resentment of the U.S., a younger generation's feeling of powerlessness, and a zest for monster movies mingle and give birth to a mandibled, slithery, squid-like, carnivorous reptile. It's utterly absurd, but it has the tang of social realism.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air is now available as a podcast on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of All Saints, a novel about a teacher's journey of faith and despair by Liam Callanan, author of The Cloud Atlas. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from Anne and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at breakthroughcollaborative.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Blackwater, USA. We'll talk with journalist Jeremy Scahill about the world's most powerful and secretive mercenary army. The organization is based in North Carolina and controlled by one man, a radical right-wing Christian mega-millionaire named Eric Prince. Join us for the next Fresh Air.